Thank you for coming today. We're going to continue with our study of Colossians. We are in chapter 3. We are going to be finishing chapter 3 and slipping on over into chapter 4 before the end of the class. We'll have two more classes after today, so we're covering our material and getting toward the end of the book of Colossians, getting towards the part of Colossians where after Paul had given a lot of discussion of the gospel and what it means and what it can do, he's talking now about how it can affect us, how it can transform us. Today we'll see the verse that talks about whatever you do, do it in the name of the Lord, a familiar verse. And so we're going to see how that applies in different relationships, different situations, different concerns that we may have. Lloyd is going to lead us in a short time of prayer, and then we'll get into some Colossians.
Father, we just thank you so much for this day. Thankful that we can come here together, that we can study your word and look into your word. And Father, we pray that what we hear today will be beneficial to us, and that you'll help us to take it into our hearts and our minds, and that we can use it to improve our lives as we strive to be more like you. Father, we are just thankful that we'll have a time of worship together also, and thankful that you're with us, and that we can have this close relationship that we have with you because of your Son, Jesus, and what he has done for us. Father, we thank you for him, and it's in his name that we pray. Amen.
Amen. All right, thank you very much. We've been in the section of Colossians where after Paul explained the difference between being motivated by law and being motivated by grace, he's been talking about a lot of things that come out of that. And the two sections that we studied a few weeks ago are kind of connected by this idea that since you, and in this part of the Colossians, the end of chapter 2, since you died with Christ, he says you don't have to live according to rules and laws and traditions anymore. Since you died with Christ, you can now live in a new way, a more sincere way. And then at the beginning of chapter 3, he says, since you were raised with Christ, you also no longer have to be controlled by yourself, by your selfish desires, by your earthly ambitions, by your selfishness. So these transform us then through the power of the gospel. And the passage we looked at last week had this phrase that Christ is all and is in all. That Christ is everything. Christ is your life now, not your career, not even your family, not even the church, not even your ministry. Christ is your life. And he also is in all. He is in everybody. If Jesus were just another lawgiver with a new set of rules, then it wouldn't be really fair of him to just expect us to follow all his rules. But he is in us. He has a relationship with us. He lives in our hearts. We live in him. And that is able to transform us. And the key concept in this part of Colossians is newness. He talks about how we have a new life. We have a chance to start over again. The law was nailed to the cross, and its accusatory power was nailed to the cross. Our self was nailed to the cross. Our selfishness and our ambitions and our materialism and our divisiveness were all nailed to the cross, and we can start over again. We also have a new identity. There is no more any Jew nor Greek, nor slave nor free, nor male nor female. We have a new identity defined in terms of our relationship with God, not in terms of the things that the world thinks are important. Since each of us has a new identity, we're also part of a new community. The community as a whole should reflect the values of the gospel, the newness, the change that comes over us, the new way that we're able to interact with each other. And this is what we'll be seeing in some of the verses we look at today. And he also has an interesting concept that we have new clothes. That the things that characterize us, the things people see when they look at us in Christ, should not be our outward appearance or our literal clothes or our career or who we are in the world. It should be the fruit of the Spirit. When people look at us, we should be clothed with Jesus, clothed with his grace, clothed with his compassion, clothed with his mercy. And so that's kind of the place where Paul has been. And what he's going to do now is he's going to get into some things that are some particularly challenging ways in which we can apply these ideas. You know, this verse about men and women and the way that they interact, the verse about the young and the old, the idea that there's so many things in this world that strain our relationships with each other and strain the ways that we get along together. You know, you talk about men and women, young and old, employee and employer, whatever you want to say. A lot of times, those things go together like Lloyd Snyder and coffee. They just don't mix very well. There's just a problem when they come into contact. Well, they're kind of meant to go together more like Larry and Janet in coffee, who love their coffee and who basically can't function too well without it. So this is the thing that we're talking about. And when we reread here Colossians 3, verse 18 and 19, these are unfortunately misused and misinterpreted in so many ways that we'll have to do a little detective work to reconstruct what they actually mean. Ben, since you've got that there, could you read verses 18 and 19? And then, Dot, could you cue up Genesis 3, 16? Don't read it right now. We'll get back there in a little bit. You're going to help us out when we get stuck here. Go ahead and read just those two verses. We want to talk about these by themselves.
Wives, submit to your husbands as is fitting to the Lord, in the Lord, as is fitting in the Lord. Husbands, love your wives and do not be harsh with them.
Talks about wives and husbands. Actually, that's kind of an interpretation of the usual Bible translators. Literally, it just talks about women and men. Literally, it says women honor the men, men love the women. That's literally what it says. It's kind of interpreted that way as applying to husbands and wives, but it really means something a little bit more general. And that's the principles are valid either way. Now, these are the kind of verses that a lot of times people really don't bother to try to think about them. They just kind of pick the interpretation that fits their little view of the world. You have these usual suspects. You have the usual suspect of, well, I think it means that the husband is the lord of the manor and that's just it. And if we're Christians, wives just need to submit. And then you have the other one, well, that's kind of just something for back then. We don't even need to deal with it at all. Those are the usual suspects. And if you know the phrase, the usual suspects, where that originally comes from is the classic movie Casablanca, which is set in North Africa when it was controlled by the Nazis in the Second World War. And in the movie, whenever there's a crime or a problem, the police captain says, round up the usual suspects. And they drag in everybody they don't like, and they pick someone and blame them for the crime. Just whoever's convenient. They don't bother to investigate or figure out who did it. It's just whatever's convenient. And so, from their point of view, one crime, one punishment, everybody's happy, except for the guy who got punished for something someone else did. And that's kind of what we do with a lot of verses in the Bible. We hear these little options that people give us, and we just pick the one that's convenient instead of digging in a little bit. There's two major clues, as well as some other ones, that should tell you that this is saying something a lot more profound than just bossing people around and who gets to be in charge. Because it says in verse 18, whatever it means to submit to your husbands, and we'll talk about that in a little bit, why does it say to do it? It says because it's fitting in the Lord. It doesn't just say because it's what they expect or because it's what everyone else is doing or it's because of what society does. There's something that he's saying that's fitting in the Lord. Then, if you think about the book of Colossians as a whole, what did Paul go to great lengths to tell us not to do in chapter 2? Not to make rules. He said, don't make rules. It doesn't work. It doesn't cure anything. It doesn't fix anything. It doesn't do anything that God really wants. So why, after going to all the trouble of explaining why rules don't work, would he just make up a few of his own? Now, if he were a member of the churches of Christ, we could do that, because that's what we do. We say, we're saved by grace, but our rules are good rules. The other rules, no, they're bad, but our rules are good, so you've got to follow them. Now, see, it doesn't have anything to do with the rule. It's just silly. And so instead of rounding up the usual suspects, we're going to play detective. We're gonna see if we can play Hercule Poirot or Jane Marple and figure this thing out. We're going to find out what these are really talking about. Now, Dot, could you read Genesis 3? Could you read 16 through 19? 16 and 17 really are the key here, but we'll read the others because they'll come up in a little bit. Thank you very much. And I will apologize, I'm a little disoriented up here. The kids have been playing tic-tac-toe, so all that there's all these little stubs of chalk, so I'm going to have to switch chalk here periodically. Okay, you know the background of the story, right? The first sin. We're not going to go back through all that. There's a lot of things worthy of studying for its own sake. I taught a class on Genesis a couple years ago, and in respect for the people who were in that class and survived it, as well as the ones who didn't make it all the way through, I'm not going to go back through the whole thing about Genesis 3. But the point is that after the fall, what Dot read is what God says to Adam and Eve, to the man and the woman. And it's usually referred to as the curse that he puts on them. And you'll notice some of the things that he says are directed towards the woman and some are directed towards the man. Now, what is this all about? That's the question, because the way, again, the usual suspect with this verse is God got ticked off and he had to think up some way to punish them. So, okay, you're going to get bossed around by your husband. You're going to have to work your tail off from now on. How do you like that? Next time, don't break the rule. Is that what he's saying? Well, I hope you know that's stupid. That's just ridiculous. What he's saying is, what did they really lose when they sinned? What was the real loss? That's right. And most specifically, before they ate the forbidden fruit, where did they live? In God's presence. That's the key phrase right there. God was right there with them. And so when they separated themselves from God, you know, my old friend Isaiah, your sins have separated you from God. He could no longer live in their direct presence. And because they were separated, a lot of other things happened. When God says these things to them, he is not punishing them. He is not saying, okay, here's your punishment. You know, go to bed without your supper and you can't have any video games or anything like that. That's the way we do things. Whatever we don't like, we just kind of make up something that makes us feel better that we punished it. What God is saying is, hey, because you did that, this is the way your life's going to be because I can't be as close to you as I used to be. I'm not going to be able to protect you with my perfect love and compassion anymore. You're going to start mistreating each other. And when you get out in the world, I'm not going to be there right in that garden with you. It's going to be a lot harder. You're going to have to work a lot harder to get your needs met now. That's what he's saying. It's not a punishment. And it's only a curse in kind of a metaphorical sense that now you're going to have to know what it's like to live without being in God's presence. And one of the aspects of this curse is dysfunctional relationships. And that's what he's talking about. And this is what he mentions to Eve, the woman, is he says, two things are going to happen. And it's not, this is the way it's going to be now because you need to be taught a lesson. It's just, hey, I'm really sorry, but now I can't be there to guide you into this perfect relationship you had in the garden. And unfortunately, this is what's going to happen from now on. See, when they were together in the garden, what were Adam and Eve? Remember why he created them, the two of them to begin with, to be helpers, to be companions, to be friends, to be partners. They were completely equal. They were at each other's side. They were so comfortable with each other, they even went around without their clothes on. Well, what's going to happen now is they're going to be transformed into rivals. What does it say is going to happen with the woman? Back in verse 16 of Genesis 3, it says, you're going to do what to your husband? Your desire will be for your husband. And that doesn't mean you're going to be attracted to your husband. The same verb in Hebrew is used in the next chapter, in Genesis chapter 4, after Cain kills his brother. And God says to him, sin desires to have you, in chapter 4, verse 7. It's the same verb. What did sin desire to do to Cain?
Take over,
control, dominate, manipulate. What is God warning Eve is going to happen now? She's going to want to control, dominate, manipulate her husband. And what's going to happen in return? He's going to rule over. Why is he going to rule over you? Because it's God's will that the man is the lord of the castle?
He doesn't want to be dominated.
Well, why do men usually get away with shoving women around? Because they're bigger, that's all. It's nothing profound. It's just that they're bigger and they can get away with it. And what he's saying is that the fall, it's not a punishment that here now God's going to, you know, the classic ridiculous thing. Well, Eve ate the apple first, so I guess that's why women have to submit. It's just idiotic because the whole point is what he's saying is, unfortunately, this is what happens when you don't live in God's presence. Men are bigger and they're going to shove people around. And women are much better to look at and they're more emotional, so they're going to learn to manipulate men. They're going to learn to dominate them that way. And that's a pretty good description of what goes wrong in relationships between women and men most of the time. The world teaches men hey, you can get your way by screaming and banging on things and threatening to beat people up if you don't get your way. The world teaches women, you know, if you play your cards right, you can really have your man wrapped around your little finger. And it's basically the curse then is that this is what has happened, is these dysfunctional relationships unfortunately typify so much of human relations. That's why relations between men and women are so strained so much of the time. It's why men basically, any chance they get, go run off and hide out with other men, and women run off and hide out with other women because they don't want to deal with these mysteries. So if you come back then to Colossians 3, can you figure out what he's really saying? Can you figure out what he's really saying in Colossians 3, especially in view of all these things he's told us, that everything is made new and everything's put back the way it was supposed to be in all these other areas of our lives? What is he really saying in Colossians 3? He's really saying that the gospel can reverse this curse. The gospel can put our relationships back the way they were supposed to be. What is the woman supposed to do? Well, unfortunately, submit or be submissive is just a choice of the word. It's actually in Greek what's called a middle voice verb. It's not an active verb. It actually means be submissive or honor or respect. The woman is being called to respect and honor men. How does that connect back with what God told Eve? Well, it's the opposite, isn't it? Instead of wanting to manipulate men and use your emotions and your appearance to get their way, show them a little respect. See, men, for those of you who don't have a Y chromosome, men are excruciatingly insecure about women. Men do not understand women. They don't want to. They're terrified of you. I know they don't act like it. I know they act the opposite way, blustering around and making up a lot of silly things to get their way. But see, the world conditions men to evaluate who they are based on accomplishment and based on achievement. What can I accomplish? What can I do? What can I show off? The world conditions women to basically learn that, okay, we're a little bit smaller, but we've got a lot of other weapons at our disposal here. And even in the most misogynistic societies, such as ancient Athens, which was notorious for its legal discrimination against women, it was also a laughingstock amongst the other Greek cities because it was notorious that the women got whatever they wanted, even though they had no legal rights. You'll read some of Aristophanes' plays. They're hilarious because it's exactly human nature. It's this battle of the sexes that's been going on. And there's a lot of imagery that different cultures have used. You know, the Asians call it yin and yang, or in pop culture we have being right-brained and left-brained, or being from Venus and being from Mars. And the whole point of it is that these relationships were meant to be complementary, were meant to be partnership. It's irrelevant who's in charge, because that question should not come up if things are being done healthily. Women need to respect men for two reasons. Because it's what men need, because men are woefully insecure, regardless of what they look like on the outside. And women do often get trained by the world to think that they're really better than men, because they're more in tune with their emotions and what really counts. Men need to love women, because the world teaches men to evaluate themselves based on their accomplishment. Men do not love women. Men like to think that they're loving women by going and collecting a lot of material objects and dumping them on their women, or by proving that they're more dominant than other men and then expecting their woman to be proud of them because they're more dominant than other men. That's not love. That's just showing off. And the thing that we learn in Colossians is to repair the relationships, this is what to do. And you know, Paul knows that everybody's different. Paul's aware that not every man is the same and not every woman is the same. It's a generality. That in general, to repair the rift from the curse, men should learn to show genuine love for women, and women should learn to show genuine respect for men. And you see, the question doesn't even then arise then, well, what if your husband's abusive? What if your wife just cries all the time? The question doesn't even arise, because it's not about who's in charge. It has nothing to do with who has to submit. The whole scripture tells us when we have trouble with each other, we're supposed to work it out. We're not supposed to resort to who gets to make the decision and who gets to boss people around. We're supposed to learn to show these genuine qualities. You know, the novelist Marianne Evans, who ironically wrote under the pen name of, literature fans, George Eliot, because she in her society, women were not, it's not considered appropriate to write. But she herself said, our society teaches women that they can make 2 and 2 5 if they just cry about it enough. And she didn't mean that as a criticism of women. She meant that as a criticism of the weakness of men, that that's their view of women. But it also is kind of a subtle way of saying that, unfortunately, that's the way the world trains women. Is just you talk with other women and learn how to get your way, and men they sit around and talk about how they can impress each other, or how they can impress the women folk with their great material collection of goods and things like that. Men need to learn to love women. Women need to learn to respect men. And if you do that, then you never need to argue about who's in charge. You never need to worry about what to do if some bad things happen. You can respect a man, even if he's a complete troglodyte, and most of them are. I'm well aware of that. I've been a male for a long time. I know how the male mind works. Now, I have a Y chromosome, but I have a very good informant, and I have others who are not here who are very good informants as to what it's like in the world of those who lack a Y chromosome. And so I understand both sides of it pretty well. You know, if women learn to show men genuine respect, you can show that even when they're misbehaving, and even if you have to do things to discipline them in a more Christ-like way, even if you have to call attention to their faults, you can still show a basic respect instead of just thinking that you're superior because you're more in touch with certain side of you. Men need to learn to show women a lot more love. It's not love when you just shower your family or your girlfriend with a lot of material things. That's not love. Love is showing genuine compassion, listening, paying attention, relating, engaging. And see, if both sides do that, it makes a big difference. A good example of real love for your wife, you know the famous ocean liner, the Queen Mary? You know how it's got its name? It was originally supposed to be the Queen Victoria. That's the way that it was all built and designed. And an executive from the Cunard line happened to be at a royal reception one day, and he was proud of this great ocean liner they were building, and this was when George V was King of England. And he happened to mention, oh, you know, we got this great ocean liner. You're going to be really proud of it. And not only that, we're going to name it after the greatest of all English queens. And King George said, oh, my wife is going to be so happy. And then what can they do now? That's too late. They're not going to displease the king. You know, and Queen Mary, his wife, was basically just a nice woman. That's basically it. She didn't do anything. But to George, he just adored her. He just thought she was wonderful. He doted on her. He listened to her. He loved her. He gave her what she wanted. He had a great relationship with her. And so to him, it was just a natural thing. The greatest queen, you know, Queen Victoria and Boudica and all the great other queens of history, they're nothing compared to my Mary. So naturally, they're going to name the ocean liner after her. That's the way men ought to feel towards their wives. And wives ought to understand the insecurity that goes with being a male, and the fact that left to themselves, males are just going to stand around and, you know, when I was in high school, males just boasted about who had the biggest engine in their car. Now, men boast about who has the latest software release. It's the same silly thing. It's the same ridiculous thing. And unfortunately, women left to themselves will just share their feelings and talk about it and try to fulfill get emotional satisfaction. And that's really not ministry either. Your ministry has nothing to do with accomplishment or excitement, and it really doesn't have anything to do with emotional satisfaction. Ministry has to do with rising above our personal ambitions and rising above our emotions and being like Christ, getting on that cross, because that's what Jesus did. When Jesus left this earth, you could write his list of earthly accomplishments on a postage stamp. When Jesus left this earth, you could make an encyclopedia about all the ways that people mistreated and misunderstood him that he never said anything about. And that's the call, is for us both to come back. Now, you may want to go back to the usual suspects after that. But just open your mind to it a little bit. And I know for some of you, opening your mind means it gets pretty drafty in there. But you can try it once in a while. That this is what it's talking about in Colossians. It's none of this trivial stuff about who gets to be in charge in the family. Even the NIV, which I read out of basically because it's what most of you characters like, it even says at the head of this little section in Colossians,
rules for Christian households.
Right. Yeah, the whole book is about the rules are no good. So Paul's just going to toss in a few of his own. But think about that, because it's really saying something that's quite profound, and it's very challenging. It's challenging for men and women alike. But see, that's how you know it comes from God. If it were men get to be in charge, you'd know it wasn't from God, because that's not the way that God is. God doesn't favor any group. God doesn't favor the young, the old, men, women. He calls us all to challenge ourselves and to deal with the things that we most want to avoid dealing with. And this kind of continues in this next passage. Lloyd, are you back in Colossians 3?
Yes.
Could you read the rest of this passage, pick up in verse 20 and read through the first verse of chapter 4.
Children, obey your parents in everything, for this pleases the Lord. Fathers, do not embitter your children, or they will become discouraged. Slaves, obey your earthly master in everything, and do it, not only when their eye is on you and to win their favor, but with sincerity of heart and reverence for the Lord. Whatever you do, work at it with all your heart, as working for the Lord and not for men, since you know that you will receive an inheritance from the Lord, a reward that is reward. It is the Lord Christ you are serving. Anyone who does wrong will be repaid for his wrong, and there is no favoritism. Masters, provide your slaves with what is right and fair, because you know that you also have a master in heaven.
Okay, thank you very much. As you can see, this gets into some other things that are very similar. And again, these are not rules or laws. This is the way that coming back to the gospel can repair all this dysfunctionality in our relationships in our society. And this first example, young and old, or specifically children and parents, that's another constant friction, tension in human society. You know, the young and the old, parents and children specifically, it's something a lot of people in the world have a great deal of trouble handling in a constructive manner. It says children can please the Lord by doing what their parents say. And for those of you who like the Greek, that actually is an active verb. That's a different verb tense than what it's told to the women. The women, when it says, it's translated as submit, it really just means be submissive or be respectful or honor. It doesn't mean action. The children, it says, yeah, you do what your parents tell you because that will please God. Because when you're a young child, your parents are there basically to do what? To take care of you. They're taking care of you. When you start off in life, you don't know very much. You need somebody to rely on you. You need someone to rely on. And you need someone to teach you the basics of what's healthy and what's unhealthy. Now, when you get a little bit older, it's still a good idea to listen to people that are older, but it's not a law, it's not a rule. It becomes a generational tension a lot of times because young people tend to think that they know everything. Young people tend to see the world the way it is to them, and they don't realize that it's a lot more complicated than it seems after you've only been around for 20 years or so. In Waukegan, Illinois, there's an elementary school named after Jack Benny, the famous comedian, because that's where he grew up. He grew up there, and they were proud of him, and I'm sure he's the most famous person ever to come out of Waukegan, Illinois, and so they built a grade school for him. They named it after him. And he used to go back, and whenever they wanted, he was very appreciative of their respect for him, and anytime they wanted, he'd go back and talk to the teachers or talk to the parents. And one time, they invited him to come back to talk to the children. And so they said, you know, you're funny. You know, tell a few jokes, and then, you know, if the kids want to ask any questions or anything like that. So he told some jokes, and then they said, does anyone have any questions for Mr. Benny? And one little girl said, Mr. Benny, why are you named after our school? Because, see, to the kids, that's what it looked like. We go to the Jack Benny school. This guy's named Jack Benny. How does that happen? Why does he think he can have the name of our school? Well, see, when you're young, what happens? You look at the world through your own experience. You think that what you've experienced is everything. And you don't realize that, you know, the world's gets more and more complicated as you get older. You realize less of how little you know as you mature. See, unfortunately, the other side of this is, how are the parents supposed to treat their children? Now, parents, you lay down the law to your kids. You make sure that they eat their vegetables. You make sure they don't stay out late. Whack them around if they disobey. No, what does it say? Do not provoke. And specifically, be gentle. Be gentle with them. Why? Because you should remember what you were like when you were a kid. Now, just a tip for those, there are a few of you who are still young in this class here, get to know your grandparents. and ask them to tell you about what your parents were like when they were kids. My grandmother used to love to tell me what my mom was like when I was a little girl. And there's nothing like getting yelled at by your mom and being able to say, "Mom, Grandma said you did the same thing when you were a little girl." That's a very powerful tactic right there. But what it's saying is, parents should remember what they were like when they were kids and be gentle. Same thing is true in a broader parallel with the young and the old. The younger generation always thinks it knows best. It always thinks that things have always been this way. It always thinks that nobody's ever thought of trying to change it before. It always thinks that the things that are important to them are the things that really matter. They don't realize that some of these old timers have seen a lot and been through a lot, and that's why they're a little bit different in way of looking at things. And unfortunately, the older generation usually has one of two foolish ways of dealing with the younger generation. They either just criticize and want to boss them around, and why don't they just do what they tell us, or they cater and enable, just try to give them everything they want and make them like us that way. And both are quite spiritually irresponsible. The older generation is called to be gentle, simple as that. The younger generation is called just to show a little respect for the fact that you don't know everything yet. That's as simple as that. The older generation's got to remember, I was young too. We were like that. We were a bunch of young know-it-alls. I know what some of you were like 20 and 30 years ago, and it's true. And so we have to learn to show that gentleness and realize, yeah, there's a lot of things that you can only learn by experiencing it. If a young person is a little bit more mature, yeah, maybe they'll listen and you can save them a lot of heartache. But sometimes they got to find it out by themselves. Sometimes they just got to bull ahead and do it and find out why you told them not to do it. We're that way with God. See, all the things that God tells us not to do, you go all the way back to Genesis chapter 3. He said, don't eat that fruit. And then when they ate it, I'm sorry, here's the reason why I told you not to eat it, because this is what's going to happen now. It wasn't a punishment, it was just, hey, when you don't stay close to God, when you don't keep humble, when you don't keep loving God, bad things happen in your relationships. A lot of things go wrong. This next passage is kind of yet a different application about serving in sincerity. And he specifically addresses servants, or sometimes it's translated slaves, it really means bond servants. And just as an aside, this passage really isn't addressing the obvious injustices that are inherent in any human society. There's economic injustices and social injustices in every human society. And this passage here is often, again, misused in the same way the verses about husbands and wives can be misused, either to blame the Bible for not taking a stronger stand or to excuse it away as something. But it's really not talking about that. It's really acknowledging the fact that, yeah, in this life, it's pretty unfair. So here's what to do about it. If you're one of the people who gets stuck in an unfair situation, serve in sincerity. You know, the early Christians, within a couple hundred years, brought about a lot of major changes in their society. But it wasn't by getting angry and having riots and cursing people and hating people the way that Christians today get when they see something they don't like. It was by doing two things. You change society by two things.
Example.
Very good. Sacrifice. The early Christians let themselves be an example, and they let themselves be the sacrifice. A lot of our brothers and sisters died in the first century and the second century, so that by the third century and the fourth century, the Roman Empire had become a much less barbaric place to live. And that's what we don't like. We want to just force it. We want to just get angry about it and make someone else make the sacrifice, instead of being the example of love and compassion and grace and maybe getting shoved around for it. He talks about then the eye and the heart. And there's a good passage, a couple good things to read. Book of Philemon is good, part because it ties in with the book of Colossians, because Philemon lived in Colossae. And then the other one is and Philemon, by the way, this is actually a much more in-depth dealing with the injustice involved. Because Philemon was a wealthy man, and he had a slave, Onesimus, who ran away. And Paul met him, and Onesimus became a Christian. And so Paul sent him back with a letter asking Philemon, A, don't punish him. It's just natural. I mean, why would anyone want to be a slave? You can't punish him for wanting to run away. And B, now he's your brother. Why don't you try to think about maybe your relationship should be different now? And that's a very good example to follow, because Paul knew that it was wrong to have slaves. But he also knew, what's changing it by force going to do? Well, the same thing as what he taught, what he told us before about laws. It doesn't really change what's in the heart. You try to force change by physical violence or force or anger or hatred, it never really changes what's in the heart. It might bring about the desired outward result. It can't change people's hearts. And that's what the book of Philemon is about. There's also this passage in 1 Peter where he says, again, to servants or slaves, he says, when your master treats you unjustly, endure it like Jesus did. Because it's not to your credit if you get punished for doing something you didn't do, but if you get punished unjustly, then God knows. God is aware. And this is what he means when he says that to do something as if you're doing it for the Lord, what he's saying is God is aware of what it's like. God chooses to give other humans free will just as he gives us free will, which means that many of us from time to time will suffer some injustice. You also got to remind yourself, most of us also benefit from some big injustices. Most of us are all the beneficiaries of a lot of injustices that other people suffered so that we can have things that we don't really deserve. And so when we start to resent things that were done, you know, your boss is crabby or you don't get the raise that you wanted, you got to remind yourself, we've benefited from a lot of unfairness. And so we need to follow the advice here. If Paul can tell a slave, someone who has faced one of the biggest injustices the world can dish out, to still serve sincerely and be a good worker and be a good example, if he can tell them that, then you know, most of us who basically have, most of us have pretty favorable material situations. I know a couple of you don't, and that's a different matter. But most of us have it pretty good. Now, my wife has a really good job. I have a job. It's not that great, but I have a lot of security. I mean, I've told people who run, the people who run the place, that they're weasels and dingbats, and I don't get fired. So I've got a lot of job security. And so I just need to appreciate that. If I don't like what they're doing, I just got to remind myself, hey, a lot of people don't have anywhere near the material things I've got. So when I'm treated unjustly, it's okay. Pray about it, talk to people about it, get some advice. Don't get angry, don't hate, and always make sure to be the example. And if someone's got a sacrifice, might as well be me. And so the eye and the heart is what he's talking about. Paul actually invents a word in this passage. When it says, don't just serve people when their eyes are on you, you know, so that you can get credit. He actually made up a word. He says, don't give eye service. It's actually a word that exists nowhere else in all of classical Greek. And I've spent a lot of my life reading these things, so I know it's not there. It's a word Paul made up, eye service. And it's obvious what it means. You know, just serving when you're around, just serving when your boss is noticing or when you can get some kind of reward for it. See, we do that in the church too, though. You know, we want to minister only if it's going to lead to a result. Only if it's going to be a number we can boast about and feel good about how exciting our church is. Or only if it's going to make people feel good and talk about what a great place it is. That's the way that we're motivated to do things, even as Christians. So this motivation is important both in life and in work and in ministry. And it's important to remind ourselves that even though the things that we do may be impositions, they may be pretty onerous sometimes, we have to remember we usually come out pretty far ahead on balance. And one of the things that he then talks about to finish the chapter is he talks about no favoritism. There is no favoritism, and he kind of turns the tables here that there's such thing as sowing and reaping. There's such thing as the things you do and the reasons you do them and the spiritual consequences. We're always so concerned with the earthly consequences. We're always so concerned, you know, if I do a good job, will I get something out of it, instead of doing a good job for its own sake. We're always concerned, now, if I do something for this person, will they do something back for me, instead of, well, this person needs encouragement, so I'll give it to them. Even in ministry, we're so concerned with, well, if we do this, will people get excited? If we do this, will it make a bunch of people become Christians and join our church so we can feel important? Instead of, Jesus would have done that, so I think we should do that. Even in the stuff that we teach and preach, it's, well, let's see, how are people going to respond to this? Are they going to like it? Are they going to get excited? Are they going to want to come to the activity that we got planned this weekend? As opposed to just saying, well, is this true? Is this something we need to deal with? Or is it just something I want to believe? That's what the difference is. He says there's no favoritism, and we should be more worried about the spiritual consequences of your action. Notorious story that you sports fans might know. About 15, 20 years ago, there was a famous college football coach who had a lot of power, made a lot of money. He was offered a job with a pro football team, make even more money, have even more power, and he took it. And the first thing he did is he went back home and told his wife he was divorcing her and leaving his family. said, I'm going to leave you a bunch of money, but I'm going to devote myself full time to this because this is my dream job. And you know what happened to that coach? He won several championships. He made lots and lots of money, and now he's wealthier and powerful than just about anybody in sports. He didn't get paid back for that in worldly terms. And that's, see, we have this false ideal that, oh, God will eventually reward me when I'm good, and he'll eventually punish people. Well, not in the way you expect. You got to think about the spiritual consequences. Well, that guy has all kind of toys and all kind of power, and everyone thinks he's a great coach and honors him and reveres him. What do you think's going on inside? Well, you'd only really know if you were him, but you can make a very good guess. You see, that's the way that we need to learn to evaluate things, is stop expecting some worldly toy every time you're good, and stop expecting every time everybody who does something bad to get smacked and get in an accident or something like that. Because that's not the way that it works. That's not the way God does things. Undoing the fall is a difficult thing, and it takes a lot of truth. Weekly, Simone Weil quote, one of her great quotes is saying that truth illuminates the soul in proportion to its purity, not by the measure of its volume. In other words, a simple truth, if it's pure, if it's not adulterated by our agendas and our craving for results and our craving to feel good, that's where the power is. Not in a lot of facts and figures and knowledge that you can try to feel smart and a lot of ways of doing things. It's in its purity. And this is where Paul comes full circle again in relationships. He says, masters, or literally it's lords, earthly lords, don't misuse your authority. Don't misuse what you've got. If you are one of the people who in this world has some authority or some influence, you better remember, to him who's been given much, much will be expected. It's not a measure of you're superior and so God's going to let you have extra toys. It's a measure of you're being held to a higher standard. Even in terms of teaching, what does James say about teachers? We who teach will be judged more strictly. And in Matthew 20, he talks about how the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them and exercise their authority. Not so with you. Whoever wants to become great needs to be your servant. And whoever wants to be the greatest must be everybody's servant. And be, again, an example and a sacrifice. Another good passage, by the way, that we don't have time to look at, James 2. Is a detailed passage on favoritism, the other side of favoritism, the way that even Christians a lot of times suck up to people because they have a lot of money. You know, we're more interested in talking to people who are good-looking or important or wealthy because we feel proud of ourselves if we can get them to join our church or adopt our beliefs, instead of realizing that every soul is the same. Read that passage because it's quite convicting to our society and the way that we do things. What you see over and over again in these passages is that grace comes with responsibility. We don't have a lot of rules and laws to follow. They've been nailed to the cross. But the opposite of law is not license, it's responsibility. We have the responsibility to learn what the gospel means in terms of how to behave. If you're a man, it tells you certain things that you cannot conform to the manly standards of the world. If you're a woman, it says there are certain things you can't conform to the woman's standards of the world. If you're an old-timer, it doesn't mean you're allowed to be a crabby old grouch because that's the way worldly people are. If you're a young whippersnapper, it doesn't mean that you can go around thinking that you're smarter than everybody else just because these old-timers have goofed everything up so badly, which I know they have. I know we have. It's not that there's not differences between us. It's not that there isn't a difference. God made it that way. God made male and female, he created them. And as the French say, vive la différence. I'm glad that he did it that way. But it does mean that we can't conform to the world's descriptions of what it means to be a man or a woman. There's always going to be old people and young people. That's kind of the natural way of doing things. And it's good. It's healthy. But you got to learn not to conform to the world's standards of what it's like to be young or the world's standards of what it's like to be old. Employee, employer, whatever else you want to put in there, it's always going to exist, and vive la différence, but we have to learn that we're put together to complement each other and to become close, not to fall into the comfortable little stereotypes and habits of the world. Trivia time to finish up. Potpourri trivia today. There's something called Townsend's Solitaire. What do you think it is? Do you think it's a casino game? Do you think it's a cut of diamond? Do you think it's a songbird? Do you think it's a historical incident? or do you think it's a type of crime? Well, I brought a picture of one, so which narrows it down if you're paying attention. Yeah, I'm afraid this is kind of a nasty little trick. This is a stealth wildlife illustration, I'm afraid. Townsend Solitaire is this cute little gray bird down at the bottom of the page here. They're about the size of maybe a small robin. They're a little bit smaller than a robin. They're called a solitaire because they're a songbird, but unlike most songbirds, they don't flock. They're actually kind of antisocial. And a lot of it has to do with the fact they have a very specialized diet. Most songbirds are very social and they sing a lot and they have little flocks and that. Townsend solitaires have a very particular diet. About 95 or 99% of what they eat is juniper berries. They won't eat hardly anything else. In the summertime, they'll eat a few insects to get a little protein. But in the wintertime, they eat only juniper berries, and even in the summer, they eat almost exclusively juniper berries. Now, the juniper is what our brother Larry would refer to as a coniferous tree. And it has this pretty little bluish-violet fruit berry. It actually is really, it's not a fruit. It's not really a berry. It's really a seed cone. It's really the juniper's version of a pine cone. And these solitaires, that's all that they'll eat. They're fanatics about it. And it's a strange thing because the juniper berries are toxic. You know, there's only a couple kinds that you can eat without getting seriously ill. There is one kind of juniper berry that the Native Americans in the West, they discovered how to prepare it so that you can eat it and it suppresses your appetite. And so some of the Western tribes a long time ago used to save juniper berries and prepare them when there was a famine because it suppressed your appetite so that you wouldn't get too hungry when there wasn't enough food. But otherwise they're toxic. They make you very ill or kill you if you eat them. Most animals can't eat them either. Birds can. Birds can digest them, and that's how juniper trees get spread. Well, solitaires are very protective of their territory, which is why they don't flock, because junipers are kind of hard to find, and since that's all they eat, they're not like most birds that they can just find any old thing to eat. And so Townsend solitaires will very aggressively protect their little flock of juniper trees. They'll attack much bigger birds. You know, they'll attack hawks or owls or something to keep them out of their juniper trees so nothing eats it. It's kind of a weird thing because the only kind of bird they'll tolerate is robins. You know, they're kind of cousins of robins, and I guess that's professional courtesy or something like that because they won't chase robins away. But any other kind of bird, they'll vigorously chase away. And the result is that juniper trees are just as dependent on Townsend solitaire as the solitaires are on the juniper trees. I read an article by a botanist once. He said that there's this whole region in California that all those juniper trees, they wouldn't be there if it weren't for the solitaire, the Townsend solitaire, because it's all that eats them in that area. It's the only thing that will, and their little berries are dependent on being digested by a bird to have a new tree be planted. And the solitaire is the only thing that'll eat them. And so it's kind of a fascinating example, one of many in nature, of a very strange kind of symbiosis. Two very different kind of organisms that complement each other perfectly. The juniper can't spread without the solitaire, and the solitaire can't live without the juniper berries. It's an example, one of many, that God has woven into our world to help us to see this is the nature of things, that we are mutually dependent. And instead of viewing each other as rivals, instead of identifying yourself as what group you're in and how you're going to do battle with these other groups out there, instead of these tribal instincts that we all have, is to learn that there's a very important dimension to the cross that puts our relationships back the way they were supposed to be. And when we take these verses in here and see them as who gets to be in charge and who gets to make the decisions, it's such a sad thing because there's such a glorious thing that it's really telling us of how we can undo the curse of dysfunctional relationships and undo the curse of the fall. Even in the instructions to workers and slaves, that's undoing the curse too. Your work doesn't have to be a horrible burden. You can do it for the Lord. If nobody else appreciates it, God still does. It undoes so many of the things that make life otherwise kind of miserable. And so when you look at Colossians, just open your mind a little bit to a different way of seeing it, and you can see it's really a grand thing that Christ is all, and he's in all, and he's everywhere. And if we can just step back a little from our agendas and our human desires, you can really see how glorious the cross is and the glorious things it can do for you. It's not going to be necessarily a lot of worldly benefits, but the spiritual consequences can be very, very powerful. Thank you so much for your patient attention. We'll continue in Colossians next time.